This is London Calling.
London Calling.
It's clear there was a major government effort in the United States, in Great Britain, across the EU, and it's now happening around the world where there has been significant censorship over the last 3 years of disfavored views that were often very accurate, including telling people's personal experiences of an experimental drug's side effect. It's been in the public interest to fight for knowing the side effects of drugs.
Welcome to London Calling with me, James Dunningpole, and my very good friend, Mr. Toby Young. Tobes, I'm proud to say that one session in the gym with my son paid off. Because yeah. I just went to my chiropractor for one of my routine, like, you know, how bad is my back sessions. And I said, I hope you're going to tell me that my back's okay. And he said, well, it's all right. But what I did notice is when you took off your shirt, you had quite good muscular definition.
Wow.
So, and that was just after one session. I think I've got one of those bodies that is, you know, I'm like a racehorse, as we know. And it responds very quickly to...
Wow, that's a very immediate result. I thought took a bit longer than that before you began to see results. But
one of the things, to be fair, I do already go for one fitness session, you know, one PT session a week. So by doubling it, I mean, by doing two, I doubled my rate. Apparently, you're meant to do at least two, aren't you, at our age? Otherwise, you are.
I've got to get around to it. My children, like yours, are constantly telling me I need to start going to the gym and doing some resistance training.
Have you noticed that generation, our kids' generation? I mean, I think, you know, even though your kids are a bit younger than mine, I think that broadly they belong to the same generation, same cohort. They're much, much more into the gym than our generation. I mean, almost any generation. I think they're real gym bunnies.
Yeah, I think that's probably generally true. Though I went through a stage in my 20s when I used to go to the gym pretty regularly. I got into it when I was a graduate student at Cambridge. Actually, no, I first got into it when I was a graduate student at Harvard. This isn't just a way of dropping into the conversation that I went to Harvard.
Of course it bloody is. We all know. You're so transparent.
But yeah, no, I first got into it. I first began going to the gym when I was at Harvard, and I took up swimming too. And I lost a fair amount of weight and began to bulk up a little bit at the same time, muscularly, from a muscular point of view. So, and it stuck with me for a while. So maybe I was a bit of an outlier back then.
So problem is, Tobes, I've had a really annoying day today because I was doing my Spectator TV review, of which more in a moment we'll talk about some of the things I've been watching. But then I heard this noise, this water pouring noise outside. And it was the noise of my son overflowing the shower and the water going through the floorboards and taking out all the electrics. Yeah. And so I, tiny things like I've got quite a sort of bad short-term memory. You know, I couldn't remember the name of the actress who played blah, blah in thingy, what's her name, and so on. And all these things I could no longer do because I couldn't gain access to the internet to look up this stuff. All these things that take. So I ended up sort of bashing it out on my laptop, which I hate doing because the posture is appalling. And you know, as we were suggesting earlier, at our age, you've really got to take care of your posture, otherwise you know, and your muscles and everything else, because you just decay and become all crap. And then I had to go to my chiropractor, which I mentioned earlier. And then I had to grab some lunch and then do this. So I'm feeling a bit flustered. Is probably.
Understood. Could you not connect to the internet using your phone or look up the actress's name on your phone?
No, because unlike you, you've got the ether in London, which is full of signals. We don't have that here. We live in an area where you are dependent.
In a not spot rather than a hot spot.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Now, so, just on that, James, I've noticed one thing that irritates me about my children is how long they spend in the shower. I'd always thought of the shower as a very quick, efficient alternative to a bath. A bath takes, you know, at best 20 minutes. So you have to run it and then adjust the temperature. You have to get in, get out, let the bath water out. But a shower, I can get in and out of the shower, do everything I need to do in about 3 minutes. Yeah, so I just don't understand why my children just stand there, you know, in the flow, luxuriating for seemingly hours on end.
Can I ask you some questions, Debbie? Are they male teenagers by any chance?
They are male teenagers, yeah.
What do male teenagers do all the time?
I don't think that's it.
Well, you say that. I mean, I remember from my male teenage days that sometimes it can be quite, you know, require a lot of effort before you finally get there. So I that would be my analogy. It's a horrible thing.
But your son's no longer a teenager, so that can't be his excuse, surely.
Who knows? Who knows? It's horrible thinking of our children in this way. It just like they find it appalling to think that we might have any manner of a sex life at our reverend age. It's and the other thing I wanted to mention to you, I learned on my health trip today, was that the large amount of money I spent on orthotics at my what orthotics are, they're these sort of inserts you put in your feet because your feet start to collapse. And so my son
is it because you've got
fallen arches?
Are you flat-footed, or your arches have fallen, have they?
Yeah, well, that's the same thing. I'm flat-footed.
But so you weren't born flat-footed. You developed flat-footedness.
I probably was born flat-footed, Tobes. The thing is,
so they haven't fallen. They've always been on the ground, as it were.
I don't know. I don't know exactly. I'd rather not think about it, about the cause. I just know that my feet are just pretty pretty mank. And I spoke to my chiropractor, who I trust on these matters, and I said, yeah, are orthotics worth it? And he said, oh, let's have a look at what you've got. And he said, well, I don't know, they kind of saw you coming. They sort of okay and sort of not. I said, well, what are you telling me? He said, I think you should get some of those barefoot Maasai shoes. He said they're really good. He said that's what you want to be doing. You want to get your feet muscles working again, and the barefoot technology stuff it works and it's real, and that's what you should be doing. So that's what I'm going to do.
So you're going to get some of those barefoot running shoes.
Yeah.
Right, crikey. So what with your kale, your knot spot, your barefoot running shoes, you are basically...
Oh, I'm not. I'm past kale, Tobes.
You'll be off grid.
I'm over kale. I don't really. Yeah. I'm much more... I'm a bit like Bear Grylls. I think vegetables generally are a bit of an imposition and an unnecessary thing. They're full of poisons. Vegetables are full of poisons designed to protect the plant from insects. And we could eliminate. I mean, look, I'm preaching the talk. I'm talking the talk. I'm not walking the walk here. I would love to go full keto, but I know that I'd get so much shit from the wife that I'd never get away with it. But
is what, an all meat diet.
Pretty much, yeah. I can't be dealing with vegetables. They're stupid. They're another contract, another psyop. I mean, that whole thing about have you had your 5 vegetables a day? That's just government propaganda designed to kind of lure you away from meat.
It's not, but doesn't your 5 a day include a portion of meat? It isn't just 5 vegetables a day, is it?
Yeah, sure. The whole promotion of vegetables being some kind of essential panacea is just utter nonsense. I mean, that obviously the whole of the vegan movement is utter nonsense on stilts with bells on it. But even the promotion of vegetables, I think, is a con. We should just be eating meat. We're designed to eat meat. We're meant to eat meat.
Okay.
As Bear Grylls has, I have some doubts about Bear Grylls, but on that score, he's absolutely on the money.
Look
at his body.
Don't you find that the higher the meat content of your diet, the longer you spend on the lavatory without wishing to spell it out too explicitly?
No, not at all.
Is that because you take Complan or psyllium husks at the same time?
No, not at all. I just don't.
Fibrogel.
The only thing that I find that gives me problems on that front is morphine. When you've got back pain or something, I'm not on morphine at the moment, but I think morphine does give you tremendous constipation. But no, just eating meat is fine. Fine.
Okay. Anything of interest this weekend or in the past week, James? I spent the weekend staying with a friend in the country, which was nice. Took Caroline. She played a bit of tennis.
In what country?
Went for a walk in the grounds. It was near Basingstoke.
Do you get scared of being in the country, Tobes?
Scared of cows and
yeah, and insects and grass,
stinging
and
nettles.
Things.
Yeah, because I'm so rarely in the country.
Yeah,
scared of being run over by a horse.
Well, to be fair, Tobes, you did kill a blackbird last time I saw you. You know, you're thinking it was a crow or something.
I don't know. That must have been someone else, James. I don't think I killed a blackbird or a crow. Anyway, no, I quite like being in the country. I've sometimes sort of talked to my wife about whether we'd like to live in the country like you do. And I think we'd both struggle with being outside London, having become completely accustomed to living in London for, you know, because we've lived most of our lives either in London or other big cities. I think I'd feel a bit isolated and a bit lonely. And having to kind of drive to the shop, you know, and make a bit of an expedition of it, and not being able to rely on, you know, being able to get the internet on my phone. All of that, I think, would be, I've become so accustomed to kind of urban living that I think I would struggle a bit.
But you sound to me like a prisoner saying how handy his cell is, and he gets regular meals pushed through the hole in the floor and you know, lots of people to talk to when you get let out and stuff. I just go every time I go to Sadiq Khan's London now, I look around and everywhere seems to be under construction. All these cones and cordoned off areas of road and stuff and cranes and stuff, and you wonder what sinister purpose that has, because I'm damn sure that it is sinister. And then you get 20 mile hour speed limits so that you can't even drive normally anymore and expect not to be ticketed. That they are out to get you every which way. And Londoners seem to be, because of the boiling frog, slow boiling frog principle, you Londoners can't see what an awful place London is.
So what are the benefits of living in the country? What do you enjoy about it?
Hunting.
That can only be about half a dozen times a year. What about the rest of the time?
Yeah. Well, the green and pleasant land, I suppose.
Do you go for walks after lunch?
Yes.
You know, do you go for walks in the morning?
I go for a run every morning with the dog.
Right.
And for example, this morning I saw startled deer. With their sort of white bobbity tails bobbing up and down as they pronked away from me. I saw various kinds of, well, you know, we get green woodpeckers and stuff, and I see the swallows have come back this year again, and they're nesting in the outhouse opposite the bathroom. And I like the countryside. I mean, unfortunately, it has been industrialized by the green movement, by, you know, things like wind turbines and solar panels and stuff, so that they are slowly ruining it. But then, I mean, they're ruining the whole world. So this stuff is inevitable. It's all going. But yeah, I think the country is still, you can go a bit mad in the country without anyone noticing. You know, everyone can become a bit more eccentric and become themselves, which
that's interesting, because it used to be that people moved to cities in order to kind of be themselves, because they weren't policed by, you know, the spying eyes of members of their local rural community.
That's a good point. You could
get a bit of anonymity and a bit more freedom in the city. And if you were a bit deviant or eccentric, you generally could lead a kind of less troubled, more independent life in cities than you could in the country. I mean, one of my theories about why we're in the midst of a free speech crisis is that threat to free speech diagnosed by de Tocqueville and J.S. Mill in the 19th century, which was the tyranny of the majority, that applied in towns and villages and in rural communities where the opinion of the majority could be expressed at town hall meetings and the rest of it. And if you were a dissenter, you would be identified by your peers and socially ostracized, particularly if you trespassed on your community's sacred values. So people moved to cities, and where they could be a bit more nonconformist, and particularly if they weren't Anglicans or Catholics. Wow. But what social media has done in the last 15 years is recreate that oppressive, intolerant atmosphere of smaller communities, whereby if you now dissent within your peer group, you can be kind of persecuted and ostracized in a way that you could be in the 19th century, which means that Mill and Tocqueville's warnings are now kind of relevant again.
I agree with some of what you're saying. I mean, village communities can be sort of censorious, and they can. I mean, I don't live in a village. And one of the reasons I don't really want to live in a village, particularly, or maybe I wouldn't mind on the edge, is that people know your business, and I don't like people knowing my business. But then I suppose I'm being spied on all the time by the security services, so I suppose I should get used to the idea. I mean, you know, I don't know whether you are, but I'm sure I am. But I can't buy into your analysis that the reason that people moved to the cities was some sort of act of free choice, whereby they wanted to sort of forge a new life where they weren't being judged by petty village communities. The reason they moved to the cities overwhelmingly was economic. They had to get the work, and in the same way now there was a drive from the World Economic Forum and the Trilateral Commission and the committee, the powers that be, they want to force us into cities to realize their grand project of depopulating the country and controlling us in these designated zones. But I don't think at any stage in history has the move to towns been a kind of a sort of decision made to avoid village communities. I mean, that's not.
I agree that the main driver will have been economic, but yeah. It may have been a byproduct that greater freedom, greater social liberalism, tolerance for dissent coincided with urbanization in the 19th and 20th centuries. That benefit is now rapidly disappearing, thanks in part to the rise of social media.
Yeah, and even more so the sort of the power of the growing power of the state and the inability of people to resist, the reluctance of people to resist. I mean, we can talk about that in a bit later on, because I wanted to talk to you about these various journalists being detained and questioned for 5 hours when they come to the UK. But maybe we'll do that in another section.
Should we get onto that next? Why don't we just hear from one of our sponsors first, which is the Live-In Care Company. So are you worried about parents or a loved one who are finding it more and more difficult to take care of themselves, or who may be living with a condition such as dementia or Parkinson's? Are you starting to think about a residential care home, but the very thought doesn't sit right? At the Live-In Care Company, we truly believe that home is the best place to receive care from an expert carer of your choice and on a one-to-one basis. Home is always a calmer, more healthy, and a happier place to be. For more information about Live-In Care, please go to the liveincarecompany.co.uk or ring us for a no-obligation conversation on 0118 914 5300, and we'll be happy to help. That website address again, theliveincarecompany.co.uk.
I don't know all these people, but it was reported on Twitter, Kit Clarenberg, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who writes for an online publication called The Grey Zone, and another journalist called Vanessa Beely. Have you come across Vanessa Beely? I greatly respect her as a foreign correspondent. She currently lives in Syria, and she reports on things like what's going on in Syria and what's going on in the Ukraine and so forth. So these two, and I think one more, came to the UK. They're British born, came to the UK and were interrogated for 5 hours by the counter-terror police for writing the kind of articles which I would not have been embarrassed to write. I mean, stuff questioning the narrative about Ukraine, say, and Russia, the narrative about Syria. I mean, Vanessa, for example, has been very, very good, assiduous at exposing the scam of the, you remember the white helmets who were supposed to be heroes of the Syrian resistance and jolly good people. And in fact, they were completely in bed with one or other of the terror groups and were probably funded by the UK security services inter alia. But what I wanted to ask you was, do you think that the counter-terror police have any business interrogating British journalists for 5 hours about articles that kind of, I mean, we're talking about the kind of articles that I would write?
Yeah, no, it does see, I'm not completely across these episodes, so haven't really been following it, but it does sound pretty over the top. They live overseas, do they? And they were returning to Britain, and they were detained when they entered the country.
I don't know what Kit Clarenberg's residential stuff. Oh, he says he lives in Yugoslavia, according to his. So presumably he comes in and out. I know that Vanessa lives in Syria, but would occasionally come back to the UK. I mean, it makes me realise that. If were I ever to be driven abroad, to flee abroad, and I came back, I'll bet I'd get similar treatment.
Yeah, but why aren't you detained anyway when you return to the when you come back to the UK? Why does
that's an interesting question. All I know is that Vanessa, who I had quite a few times on my podcast, and I think is admirable, that our security services have absolutely no question, you know, no business questioning her. It seems to me an outrageous infringement of her free speech rights. And I was just curious to see what your take on this state of affairs was. When we now have journalists who are being questioned for doing their job, just reporting on stuff.
Yeah, no, it does. It sounds like something the Free Speech Union should be across. I noticed that the National Union of Journalists, which isn't the most robust of trade unions, has issued a statement objecting, I think, to the fact that Kit was detained and questioned by counterterrorism officers. It does sound pretty sinister. I guess it's of a piece with this. Did you see the Telegraph published the fruits of an investigation on Friday? I think it was. It was essentially their version of Big Brother Watch's investigation into employment of various shadowy agencies within Whitehall departments, particularly the Cabinet Office and DCMS, but also I think the Home Office, during the pandemic to monitor the social media activities of critics of the government's pandemic response. And in some cases, the departments would then use their trusted flagger status with Twitter or Facebook to try and get dissenting posts removed on the grounds that they breached the terms and conditions of the social media platforms in question because they were promoting misinformation or disinformation. And at one stage, I think one of these agencies existed in the Department for Health, and Matt Hancock at one stage, when he was the health secretary, contacted Nick Clegg to try and urge him to do something about some particular gadfly he was irritated by. But it's good that this is getting additional coverage. The Big Brother Watch report was great. And Big Brother Watch encouraged various journalists and scientists who thought that they were being monitored by these shadowy organizations, like the Counter Disinformation Unit. They encouraged them to submit subject access requests to the Whitehall departments that these agencies were based within to see if they themselves had been monitored. And I did that, and there was some correspondence about me between some of these shadowy figures working for these agencies. But it's remarkably similar to what happened in the United States, as revealed by the Twitter files, it is extraordinary that a whole apparatus an anti-disinformation sector that was created with, you know, state funding after 2016, designed to protect domestic citizens from, you know, cyber security threats from foreign powers like China and Russia, has been repurposed as a way for the state to monitor domestic citizens and penalize them in various ways for dissenting, particularly during the pandemic. But yeah, we're seeing it both in Britain and America and in Australia and in other parts of the world too. But it sounds like it's of a piece with that, that the whole apparatus of counter-terrorism, counter-extremism, which was originally set up to protect us from foreign threats, has been repurposed to police internal dissent.
Yeah, exactly. Have you got any theories on why it has taken the Telegraph and its risibly entitled investigations team, to take so long to expose a story that was written? I mean, UK Column and Conservative Woman were writing about this stuff in 2020. Laura Dodsworth published a book about this, I think, again in 2020, revealing the existence of these units and the monitoring that was going on. Then you had your Big Brother Watch report, which I don't think was, you know, I think was very, very late in the game and actually was a classic limited hangout story. I don't trust Big Brother Watch. I think their funding sources are deeply suspect. I think Silky Carlo and her boyfriend or ex-boyfriend are deeply suspect. They've got connections with the security services. I don't trust that report at all. I think it was, yeah, I say limited hangout in that a controlled release of information designed to distract. But at least it came out a few months ago. Now you've got the Telegraph, which surely a paper of record with a history of investigating stuff, breaking stories, is now 3 years late to this party. Why have they taken so long to write about it?
I don't know what the kind of history of this investigation is, or why it appeared at the end of last week. It may be because the lockdown files in the WhatsApp messages turned over to the Telegraph by Isabel Oakeshott. And incidentally, I'm going to be interviewing Isabel Oakeshott about those WhatsApp messages at Unheard on Saturday, and then again at the Hippodrome next Tuesday. And tickets are still available. Drinks tickets, dinner tickets.
That was
tickets
very
to
neat
the event
there, James, where you got Unheard. That one.
Still available. If you Google the lockdown files and Eventbrite, you'll be able to purchase tickets. They're only £25 if you want to come see us at the Hippodrome on Tuesday week. But we've got actors reading out some of the more embarrassing bits from the WhatsApp messages. We've got an actor playing Boris Johnson, an actor playing Matt Hancock. It should be an entertaining evening. But it could be that the Telegraph investigation was prompted by some things which turned up in Matt Hancock's WhatsApp messages.
This was all in the public domain. It was all, there's not a single thing in that Telegraph alleged investigation that is remotely new. It's all old stuff.
I mean, you
mentioned Big Brother Watch. So that they've cobbled together something from that. But as I say, the Conservative Woman and UK Column, And I mean, generally people who use the internet, you know, people on my side of the argument, we're all aware of this stuff. We didn't turn to our Telegraph and go, goodness me, it seems that a government unit has been spying on us all this time. Come on.
Well,
you can't defend these people.
Don't be ridiculous, James.
They are. I'm not being ridiculous. The media is utterly corrupt, and it has been withholding key information from us in our interest. The Telegraph was part of this disinformation operation. It's all very well at the Telegraph holding its nose and saying, "Ooh, pass me the smelling salt." It seems that people have been manipulated by the government. Well, the Telegraph was part of that manipulation operation for the last 3 years.
I don't think so. I think they published quite a few of the people who it turns out were being monitored by Yeah, they published me writing very critical.
No. I mean, do you still get work from them? Do you? Because I mean, I wouldn't hold a candle from the Scummergraph. So I don't know why you're bothering to suck up to them.
I'm not sucking up to them. I thought it was.
You
great.
You're taking their corner, and they're a bunch of evil, propagandizing, lying scum.
I think. I think you're. Again, it's something we've long kind of argued about, but I welcome the fact that they're drawing attention to
3 years too late
iniquitous behavior of the government during the pandemic. They shouldn't have been using taxpayers' money to monitor so-called misinformation on Twitter or Facebook, and they certainly shouldn't have been trying to persuade those companies to remove posts which they didn't like. And it's a great illustration, I think, of the danger of placing this power in the hands of senior officials and politicians. They will inevitably use machinery and resources designed to protect us from cyber threats to suppress opposition to their own policies, their agenda. And I think actually the fact that of course, I think it's great that other publications earlier on revealed this, and I welcome the Big Brother report. I don't think for a second that it was, you know, limited hangout. I think it was they did the very best they could to expose it, and they did a great job. The fact that the Telegraph is now highlighting this, I think, is fantastic news. It makes it more difficult for the government to ignore. It makes it harder for the official COVID inquiry to ignore, and hopefully will prompt kind of, you know, a proper investigation, ideally as part of the COVID inquiry, to what the government was doing and try and make it less likely that this kind of thing will happen again. I mean, these kinds of campaigns are inevitably take a while to get going, James. And it took a while for the Twitter files to be disclosed. And it was only because Elon Musk bought Twitter and was able to reveal that and give access to, you know, the data to various journalists like Michael Schellenberger and Matt Taibbi, who incidentally are coming over here to try and galvanize opposition to the censorship industrial complex, which is a global complex. They're coming over here at the end of this month, and they're having a meeting at Unheard, actually, and in Central Hall in Westminster to try and raise awareness of this kind of activity, which I think most people don't read The Conservative Woman or, you know, No Column or and various other, you know, dissident alt media publications. So most people aren't aware of it, UK Column. So it's great that it's finally been latched onto by the mainstream media. Hopefully, James, we can finally do something about it.
I'll tell you what it's a bit like. It's a bit like there's the battered body of free speech, barely alive, lying on the pavement. And this free speech body has had his head kicked in and his balls kicked in by any number of malefactors. And that includes the government's various units, the 77th Brigade, their military propaganda branch, and this the various units attached to the cabinet office and so on. And a key part of that gang, which has been kicking in free speech, has been the media, the mainstream media, the Daily Telegraph among them, the Telegraph that received $3+ million from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to propagate their pro-vax propaganda and so on. And suddenly the Telegraph, realizing that it might get found out, having been part of this mugging gang, has nipped up to the body and just sort of put an elastoplast on one of the injuries, and it says, "We are from the Telegraph with love." It's just too little too late, Topes. I don't... The one lesson, well, one of the many lessons we've learned from the last 3 years is that the mainstream media, the legacy media, is just a propaganda machine on behalf of interests which are not our own interests. They're definitely not the readership's interests. They just push an agenda constantly. And I don't think the Telegraph deserves congratulating. I say 3 years too late means they're not doing their job.
I think that moving the dial on these things, bringing about political change, making it less likely that some of the liberties the government took, not just here, but in other countries during the pandemic, making it less likely that they'll take them again. All that's going to take time. It takes a huge amount of effort and organizing. It requires us to build coalitions, to make allies where we can, and not just think we are, you know, a kind of a sort of pure originals and anyone else kind of eventually coming around to some of our skepticism about the government's pandemic response should be kind of rejected and cast out because they weren't there at the start along with us. You know, it's a long game, James. And if we want to bring about change and improve things, it's going to take a big effort. And we should not insult people who are late to the party. We should welcome them for finally getting on board.
I'm not insulting the ordinary readers who've been thoroughly misled, who trust The Telegraph and other newspapers out of habit. I'm talking about the fact that The Telegraph and other newspapers had deliberately and cynically withheld this information because they were bribed to do so by the government. And
I don't think that's true.
Well, of course it's true. You're denying that they were given lots of money in advert. The government became the media's biggest advertiser during the so-called pandemic. That buys a lot of coverage. The newspapers just gave up trying to tell the truth and. Well, not that they ever did, but they've sort of accelerated this lie program.
I think some newspapers were too quick to be persuaded by the government and their scientific outriders that the government's pandemic response was sensible and wise, and didn't want to rock the boat for fear that if they undermine public confidence in things like social distancing and mask wearing and the rule of six, that they would make it more likely that the virus would spread, people would become infected, hospitalized, and die. They were initially convinced by those arguments, that propaganda, and I think it's taken them a while to become a bit more skeptical and
that's
to question it. But eventually, I hope that most of them will come around to our skeptical point of view. I don't know if you saw there was another story in The Telegraph this morning, James, which was really quite hard hitting on the front page, reporting on a new book that has been published today by the Institute of Economic Affairs by a group of researchers, one from Johns Hopkins University, another from a university called Lund University in Sweden, saying that the collateral damage caused by the first lockdown designed to mitigate the impact of the first COVID wave in spring 2020, not just here, but across the world, that the collateral damage far outweighed any benefit. They estimate that the number of lives saved by the first lockdown in England and Wales was around 1,700, which is a tiny number.
But I mean, even if 1,700 is a tiny number, where did they get that made up figure from? I don't believe a single life was saved by the lockdown. You'd have to buy into the notion that lockdowns did anything to stop the transmission of this alleged virus, which I don't believe at all.
Yeah, so, but well, they in a sense, I agree with you. I think it's hard to demonstrate that the lockdown saved a single life. But in a way, it's quite helpful to have people who aren't as dogmatic about it as us and allow, for a variety of reasons, that it did save some lives. But say, even if we allow for that, the collateral damage still far outweighed the benefit. So even if you accept, even if you believe that lockdown saved lives, it still wouldn't be a good idea to lock down again because they did far more harm than they alleviated. Anyway, the language in this report and the language quoted, you know, in this Telegraph piece that about the it's described by the authors of this new paper, this new book, as, you know, the worst policy decision ever made during peacetime. So it couldn't really be more damning, even though it allows that the lockdowns did save a tiny number of lives.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think it's all the distraction, because you look at look at the line that the media has been pushing for some time, the supposed skeptical branch of the media, so columnists like Alison Pearson and say Dan Hannan, who keeps telling us that he was one of the only voices that speak out against lockdown. It's a distraction from the far bigger issue, which is that governments around the world have been poisoning their populace by forcing them to take this experimental vaccine, which isn't a vaccine. So whether or not it was a bad idea to lock people down, I mean, obviously it was a bad idea to lock people down, but I would be much happier if this admission of guilt on lockdown went hand in hand with this admission of guilt that, yes, we were poisoning you. We were doing the interests of Big Pharma. They do control us. And yes, we have poisoned you. And we did kill your mum, and we did cripple your uncle. Yeah. And we're really sorry, and we're going to do something about it. And we're not going to get in bed with these scumbags ever again. But I'm not hearing that. I'm just hearing, oh yeah, lockdown was just an honest mistake by a few idiot power crazed politicians, it was always more than that. It was always coordinated at a global level. It wasn't individual governments responding to a perceived emergency. It was coordinated. And it's interesting, by the way, that this report you quote was co-authored by the John Hopkins, who weirdly was the institution also responsible for producing the 2019 SPARS report, which predicted the pandemic with uncanny accuracy because it was planned.
Well, the I don't think it was planned, as you know, but I think there isn't a single institutional view, which is the Johns Hopkins view. But I think this particular professor at Johns Hopkins, I think it's Steve Hanke, has always been a lockdown skeptic. But I think the fact that he is a professor at Johns Hopkins is good because it gives the report an imprimatur of institutional authority. And the fact that Johns Hopkins has been, very supportive of the US government's pandemic response is quite helpful. And I think the Telegraph actually pointed this out in its piece about this new book, you know, that even a professor at Johns Hopkins, which until now has been an enthusiast for the lockdown and other non-pharmaceutical interventions, even a professor from that university is now saying it was a colossal mistake. I mean, I think in due course, I mean, they're not going to say the things you'd like them to say about the vaccines, but they may in due course accept that the harms associated with the vaccines have been underestimated, and that in many cases the benefits of taking the vaccines the harms outweigh the benefits. In due course, they may come along. They may come around to that point of view too. But it's a journey, James. It's a journey. Anyway, should we hear from another of our sponsors? I think it's your turn.
Oh yes, you sent it to me, didn't you? Hang on. I like this ad a lot. I really don't know how anyone, let alone those anti-vaxxers, could have a problem with Klaus Schwab. That lot might compare his looks to those of a Bond villain, but to me, the man has kindly, benevolent features, twinkling eyes, and a real desire to bestow gifts upon humanity. In fact, my own affectionate nickname for him is Santa Claus. So much do I feel that he has our best interests at heart. I could certainly see him in a Santa suit, children at his feet and on his knee, and him asking them which booster they want for Christmas. If you enjoyed that satirical take on Mr. Schwab, then head over to Amazon now to get your copy of the highly rated COVID satire, Busting Anti-Vax Myths, described by one Amazon reviewer as COVID meets Father Ted and by another as deliciously entertaining. This satire will provide guaranteed comic relief after years of COVID tyranny. Search Busting Anti-Vax Myths on Amazon now to get your paperback, Kindle, or audiobook version. By the way, I've heard really good, nothing but good reports of this book. So it's a strong recommend from me.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it's supposedly very, very funny. Okay, good. So what else, James? Have you been following the brouhaha about Philip Schofield in the media? I don't suppose you have very closely. I must say I'm finding it quite difficult to work up any interest about Philip Schofield's departure from this morning and whether Holly Willoughby, his co-presenter, can survive. I mean, the only thing which vaguely tweaked my curiosity, was how uncannily similar the whole scandal is to the fictional scandal in the Apple TV show, The Morning Show. For the benefit of our American listeners, who I'm sure will know nothing about this, Philip Schofield is a co-presenter of a breakfast television program called This Morning with a woman called Holly Willoughby. And he has recently departed the show under a cloud, seemingly, although it wasn't obvious straight away, but seemingly because he started a gay affair with a runner on the show who was considerably younger than him, but not below the legal age of consent.
Well, it was when he started, Tobes. That was,
I don't think so. I don't think so, no. No, no, I don't.
Yeah, totally. I'm not saying
that's libelous and not true, James.
No. You are.
Well, he may have got to know him, but I don't think there's any suggestion that
that's kind of key. People are not saying, nobody is saying that he shagged an underage boy. What they are saying is that they met him when he was much younger and he groomed him. Don't try and dilute the story to total irrelevance.
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't seen the. I think there is some. There
seems to
be some
evidence.
Let's not even
talk about it if you're going to kind of whitewash the whole thing.
I wasn't a whitewash, but it does seem a bit. It seems a bit strong to describe him as grooming this boy.
Well, in that case, the relationship was completely normal and unobjectionable, and we shouldn't talk about it. Because
I think
nothing to complain about.
Well, isn't what's seemingly objectionable about it is that if you are a senior employee, you're not supposed to take advantage of your seniority to seduce younger junior members of the same company. That's sort of that's what did for the co-presenter in The Morning Show. It was a Me Too scandal. It wasn't that it came out that there was an element of coercion in one of his affairs, but to begin with, anyway, the reason he left the company is because it was a Me Too scandal, a classic Me Too scandal, and that he'd had a sexual relationship with a junior member of staff, and that seemed to be the issue here too, apart from it was gay, which added another dimension to it.
You're just soft peddling the whole story and actually just removing all the bite out of it and actually making excuses on behalf of Philip Schofield, who is a scumbag. Come on.
Well, I wasn't trying to make excuses on this.
Well, you may be trying to, but you were. You were doing exactly that. A lot of what I've been saying has been common knowledge that this is the story that the newspapers have been dying to write about. I mean, I think it's all smoke and mirrors and bread and circuses and distractions. But if we're going to talk about it, at least let's point out the most salient point about this thing, which is that Philip Schofield, a TV presenter, met this guy when he was, I think, even a schoolboy. And I'm not accusing him of having broken the law, but he definitely did groom this guy, perhaps by promising him fame and fortune. I don't know what, but his using his celebrity and you know, I think it's far dodgier than just merely being an executive and using his powers within the company to advance, you know, to make sexual advances. You know, that's no one would care about it if it were just that.
Well, it seemingly. But all these other details that you're referring to have only sort of come out in the aftermath of his departure and seemingly as a result of kind of, you know, tabloids investigating the story rather than the reason he left the program. But I think, I don't know, we don't know that he was grooming this boy from the moment he met him. I mean, it's possible, but innocent until proven guilty. He may have just befriended him or offered him, you know, opportunities, told him how to get into television, and then subsequently kind of reconnected with him years later, by which time it was, you know, not unlawful for them to enter into a relationship. So we don't know. I mean, grooming's a little strong and suggests
I share your desire not to get the attention of libel lawyers, but I think if we're going to just tiptoe around the subject, we may as well not bother talking about it, frankly.
Well, I wasn't going to go. I wasn't going to talk. I wasn't going to. My point was not to kind of try and summarize it for the benefit of our American listeners. And so maybe you're right, and I haven't summarized it quite accurately. Now, my point was that I haven't quite understood why it's become such an enormous story, why it's dominated the news. It was at one point leading the BBC News. It is just slightly baffling that there should be such. I mean, I was going to say that I've almost come around to thinking about it in the way you usually present these things, which is that it's bread and circuses. I think it's just for some reason it's a slow news week.
That's a sort of a normie notion that there are these the news is a construct. It's never a slow news week, really. It's the news is whatever the powers that be want.
But you used to work at a newspaper. Covering the news, weren't you? There's
a
lot to cover, and sometimes there isn't much.
No, I just didn't know how the game. I didn't understand the game. I was an innocent, as you still are, I suspect.
You're always wiser than me, James. Yeah. Always the enlightened one.
Do you think we should do Culture Corner?
Why don't we move on to Culture Corner? Yeah. So, what have you been reviewing for your Spectator column this week?
It was a bit desperate. So, I started off wanting to review McGregor Forever, because I'm suddenly into these traveler boxing type, these Irish travelers who just seem to spend all their time drinking and fighting and with bare knuckles, and I used to think, you know, thieving gypsies and so on, but now I've completely reverse ferreted on this, and I think actually I love these people because they have always understood that our system is completely broken, which is why they don't want to put their children in our corrupt brainwashing education system, and I kind of respect them. They're gonna, when it all kicks off, these people are going to survive, and because they've kept their communities intact and their traditions alive and so on. So anyway, I love Conor McGregor. He's been fantastic during the lockdown and all the nonsense and stuff. And I was trying to persuade the wife to sit down and watch a documentary about him. But unfortunately, in the first 30 seconds, it showed... were you aware of this? That in 2021... he had this, he's a cage fighter, right? And he basically broke his ankle in the middle of the tournament, and you can see it breaking. And in the first 30 seconds of this program was this man's ankle being broken. And the wife said, right, that's it. I'm not watching anymore.
Right.
So we didn't get to watch Conor McGregor. Instead, we watched this terrible series written by the guy who wrote Knives Out and the Onion thing that was
Netflix. Yeah.
I really hate those, that the James Bond guy who plays the kind of queenie Southern
Daniel Craig
detective. Yeah, just the most ludicrous creative.
Is he in the TV series too?
No, he's not. No. Okay. So the premise of this is that the woman has the power to tell when people are lying. Always. Right. She knows when you're lying. I think it's been done before by, wasn't there the invention of lying with Ricky Gervais, and there's been other films about liar, I don't know.
Yeah, I think, isn't there even another detective series about a detective who's extremely good at telling whether people are lying or telling the truth, but played by a man rather than a woman? I think there is, but I can't remember.
Probably.
Which it is now.
Anyway, it's a bit wrong. Actually, what really annoyed me. So this woman she's basically trailer trash. She has a sort of hick accent, and she lives in a trailer park, and she's got a really deep gravelly sort of voice, and you think, well, this woman is going to smoke, she's going to smoke cigarettes obviously at a bare minimum, but she doesn't smoke because it's pussy TV. It's because it's like, oh, if we have our main character smoking, people might think that smoking is a good thing. And I'm thinking, no, this is just basic character depiction. You can't have a woman with a gravelly voice living in the trailer park who doesn't smoke. And it reminded me of, do you remember Cheers? Do you remember how nobody smoked in Cheers?
Yeah,
that was the
true.
Beginning of the end. It was the bar where everyone knew your name, but nobody smoked.
Right.
How stupid was that? So it lost me a bit. So I wouldn't recommend that. I bet it's not as bad though as your Arnie series. I watched about 10 seconds of the trailer for it, and it just made me feel so ill that I couldn't bring myself.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, no, it was that. That's awful and not at all recommended. All I've done, I think, from a Culture Corner point of view, well, I finished Andrew Roberts's magisterial of Churchill. I'm now giving myself some time out by listening to the very last of
Destroyer Men.
The sharp novels. So it's called Sharp's Devil, and it's set sort of about 10 years after the Battle of Waterloo, and it opens with a meeting between Sharp and Napoleon on Saint Helena, Sharp is going to Chile, and he stops on the way and has this kind of fortuitous meeting with the emperor. It's a quite a good opening scene, I'm about a quarter of the way in, and it's just getting good, so I'm enjoying that. But I finally watched the last three episodes of Succession. I was waiting.
Don't tell me.
Okay. Okay. All right. I was behind because my wife was beginning to lose interest, and it was one of those things we had promised to watch together. But she, because she's losing interest, said to me, look, go ahead and watch them. Don't wait for me. So I have now watched them, but I'll wait for you before we discuss.
Yeah,
them.
Don't give me any opinion at all, or even a hint that you might approve or disapprove. Okay. No,
and I'm still plodding my way through The Diplomat, which I think is pretty good, pretty entertaining. Have you tried that yet?
No, I don't. I don't think after your kind of lukewarmish sale the other week, I thought I can't be doing with it. Oh, by the way, another thing I would steer clear of. Did you enjoy that Chernobyl thing a few years ago?
Yes. So you're going to talk about The Last of Us.
Yes. No. Yes,
I think we've mentioned that before.
No, not that. The Days.
Okay. The Days.
So the Japanese have made this account of, they've done a Chernobyl on the Fukushima reactor. So they've made this drama series about
the disaster
in the disaster, and it's really crap. It's really embarrassing. It's not helped by the fact that because it's not set in collapsing Soviet era Ukraine, but rather is set in modern Japan, you haven't got that extra dimension of these corrupt, stonewalling, Jobsworth, useless officials. Yeah, everyone is Japanese and very keen and doing their job efficiently. And yes, I will go into to investigate this particular thing and die in the tsunami. And I will, but the acting is really crap. There are no characters, and it's just rubbish. So I wouldn't watch that.
And does it suffer from the same shortcoming as Chernobyl, in that it presents the accident as being far more catastrophic and harmful than it really was in reality?
Do you know what? I'm glad you made that point. I haven't given it the chance to, because I only watched the first episode. I don't know whether, I imagine it did. I'm very suspicious about all these narratives. I'm very suspicious about the Chernobyl narrative. I'm very suspicious about the Fukushima narrative, because I think ultimately they're designed to discredit nuclear power.
Yes, I think, that they certainly do seem to, well, Chernobyl seemed, it certainly wildly exaggerated just what harm had been caused by what happened at Chernobyl, and implied that radiation sickness was contagious. So it was viral, and if you stood next to someone with it, you could catch it, which was obviously completely ridiculous. And if you watched the whole series, you would have come away with the impression that hundreds of thousands of people died horrible deaths instead of, the true number, which was something like 50, wasn't it? Surely the kind of the most salient fact about the Fukushima nuclear accident is that it showed that a nuclear power station can literally be hit by a tsunami. It causes very little death. Exactly. Because nuclear power is so safe.
So if we'd been producers at whatever it was, Netflix Japan, we'd have said, no, we're not running this crap. It's just like, it's just anti-nuclear propaganda. Well, no, don't bore us. We don't care. That would be a good job to have. Netflix executives in charge of nixing woke or agenda pushing programs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, by the way, I'm still reading Anna Karenina, and it is still the greatest novel ever written. I think there's no question about it.
Okay, good. I must get onto it.
Yeah.
All right, James. I think we've probably exhausted everything we had to discuss. But good to talk to you, and we'll talk again next week.
No, well, I'm very glad that you're concerned about that Kit chap I mentioned, and also Vanessa Bailey, because I think we are heading for dark times. And
we'll look into that.
Good that you care.
Okay.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Bye.
Thanks.
This is London Calling.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.